Harappan civilization, the civilization along the Indus River, is shrouded in some real mystery because, among other things, we have not managed fully to interpret their writing system yet. They seem to have developed unusually elaborate cities with unusually advanced urban technologies in the sense of sewage systems and sanitation systems. So we know that their urban emphasis was quite strong, possibly even stronger than the civilizations in the Middle East and North Africa. But Harappan civilization ultimately disappeared, and frankly, we don't fully know why. Possibly invasion pressure from outside forces, possibly internal warfare. I think the leading candidate now suggests that Harappan civilization may have overextended itself in terms of the kind of economic productivity necessary to maintain its urban structures, and may have overextended also its exhaustion of the local environment so that it declined as a result of local environmental deterioration and the impact of this in turn on reliable food supplies. Chinese River Valley civilization is also a little mysterious, partly because the records, although there is written evidence, the records are not vast, partly because the Chinese later on quickly shrouded this period in considerable mystery. Chinese civilization may have emphasized the importance of the ruler and the state unusually strongly, at least compared to Harappan civilization in the Middle East. It's not entirely clear whether that's true at the time with the Shang dynasty, for example, or whether this is partly an invention of later Chinese culture, quite possibly a bit of both. But again, the point that we made with regard to Egypt and Mesopotamia can and should be extended to these other cases. Each civilization developing partially separately, in the case of the Chinese, quite separately, each civilization developed its own characteristics, which need then to be compared to other cases. However, and this is the final concern some world historians would have about this second use of the civilization concept, you don't want to press this too far. Each of the River Valley civilizations had some distinctive features. Each had a distinctive history, indeed. But it is also important to remember, and this is where you get some coherence to the River Valley civilization period in Afro-Eurasia, it's also important to remember that each of these civilizations had important common features, and we've already covered them in defining civilization itself. They all had states. They all developed important cities. They all developed important trading patterns and a merchant class. They all had writing, different kinds of writing. But these features need to be remembered. Two final points. One involves legacy, and one involves drawing the River Valley civilization period, the early civilization period, to a close. Each of the River Valley civilizations would ultimately decline, although this is somewhat complicated in the Chinese case. And the question is, how much did it leave for later? And there are three aspects to this. First, most obviously, the River Valley civilizations left an apparatus that would never have to be reinvented. Societies in these particular regions, but even more widely, would never have separately to invent the concept of states. They might invent a particular new style of writing, but the idea of writing was now well established in a minority. Other apparatus that we take for granted, like money, was introduced by the early civilizations. And that, too, was something that no longer would not have to be reinvented by later societies, even though the specific forms of money and the materials might change. So legacy number one obviously involves some of the sort of nitty-gritty of social activity that we associate with civilizations that was durably established. Legacy number two. Many of the early civilizations, and this is probably particularly true in the case of Mesopotamian Egypt, but possibly also China, many of the early civilizations, although they concentrated in river valleys, obviously spilled over into larger influences, thus Egypt, to take the most important case. Egypt had interactions with sub-Saharan African societies along the Upper Nile that would ultimately generate their own civilizations, but in contact with and in partial imitation of Egypt. So Egypt helps beget the first sub-Saharan African civilizations, and the interchange in terms of trade, mutual invasion, etc., was very important. Egyptian and Mesopotamian civilization alike spread influence into places like Greece and Crete, where, again, they would form a sort of dissemination background for developments elsewhere. So second legacy is a certain geographic dispersion that would be important later on. Third legacy is the one that really gets interesting. How much of the spirit of the early civilizations would spread to later societies? The Chinese, in their semi-mythical histories of the Shang dynasty, obviously wanted to imply that the Shang introduced the concept of political order and careful government that would later inform Chinese culture. The claim is somewhat doubtful, but it's possible. People have argued also that Mesopotamian ideas about the separation between humans and nature would influence later Middle Eastern and European cultures. Certainly specifics, Egyptian mathematics, Egyptian architecture, would have influence later on in the region. So the legacy is not just nitty-gritty, but we don't quite know how much these early societies helped define what would come later. Okay, finally then, the end of the period. It's not tidy. It would be nice if all the early civilizations collapsed in April 1000 BCE and we could say, now we're ready for the next day. Didn't happen like that. But there is a bit of a pause. Obviously, as I mentioned already, Harappan civilization simply disappeared, and it was replaced by a period in which Indo-European invaders and migrants poured into India and would begin to mix with local populations, and ultimately a new civilization phase and a partial relocation would occur as a result. In the Middle East and Egypt, Egyptian civilization, although it didn't disappear, nor did its government disappear, clearly began to falter somewhat around 1000 BCE. The great empires of the Middle East also went through a period of pause in which important local societies emerged, like Phoenicia, like Israel, with its vital introduction of the first durable monotheistic religion and associated ethics. This was a pause period that was also amplified by a new series of invasions and migrations from Indo-Europeans in Central Asia. Chinese civilization has the least clear disruption, and it really is true that the Shang dynasty flows fairly smoothly into the next Zhao dynasty, which will become characteristic of the classical period that we'll talk about next. But with the admitted exception of China, there is something of a break in civilization history around 1200 to 800 BCE that would help create the gap between the first civilization period emphasizing river valleys and the next classical civilization period that we'll begin to define next time.
Lecture 4, The Classical Period in World History.
The classical period in world history runs from about 1000 BCE, 1000 or 800, to 500 or possibly 600 CE. Little fuzziness around the edges, but that's the time period. In other words, it's about 1.5 millennia long. We will be spending several sessions on the classical period, which may surprise you since we've raced through over 2.5 million years of human history in 3 sessions thus far. This lecture is meant to introduce some of the basic characteristics of the classical period, some of the key issues, and then we'll have an opportunity to expand on some issues of detail in subsequent sessions. Not surprisingly, the classical period is a really crucial world history period, and the basic point is some of the key formative elements of major civilizations, some of what historians call the great traditions, were forged in the classical period, and they would be ingredients in world history from this point onward. And that's one of the things we'll try to amplify today. The classical civilizations focused in areas where river valley civilizations had flourished earlier, but there was usually some relocation involved and always an expansion. A key center was China, but now in the classical period, China expanded from north along the Yellow River to the southern portion as well, forming the Middle Kingdom that has remained a fairly coherent core in Chinese history from that point to the present day. Indian civilization would now spread through the whole subcontinent, and its focus would be in the Ganges River basin rather than in the northwest. Classical Mediterranean civilization would utilize some of the heritage of Egypt and Mesopotamia, but obviously would locate particularly in Greece and the shoreline of the eastern Mediterranean, and ultimately spread westward both in North Africa and in southern Europe. The classical civilization that stayed closest to its river valley roots was Persia, which also had its center initially in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, but would spread more widely in the Middle East as a whole. The classical period is easily described in terms of the separate stories of these four major civilizations: China, India, Persia, and the Mediterranean. And we'll do a little of that today. But the main purpose of this first lecture is to highlight some of the issues the classical period has in common among all four civilizations, so that we don't lose the world history forest for the trees. A secondary purpose, though I'm not trying to beat people over the head with this, is to make it clear that as opposed to the Western civilization tradition, which obviously would linger lovingly on Greece and Rome, the world history focus embraces Greece and Rome as one of the truly important classical traditions, but gives at least equal attention to other major cases. Usual caveat becoming, I'm sure, quite familiar. It's important to remember that the classical world was not yet the whole world. The classical civilizations would radiate influence to other societies. India was actually particularly influential with trade and cultural contacts with Southeast Asia and to some extent the Middle East. China would radiate influence into Korea and Vietnam to a certain degree. Greece and Rome would radiate influence into parts of Africa outside the empires proper, and obviously into Northern Europe. But the classical civilizations themselves were only part of the whole world, and some societies that would be important later on were essentially untouched by classical developments per se. At the same time, these classical civilizations, although they all utilized river valley achievements, they were all larger than the river valleys. Indeed, that's one of the main points of this emphasis on some coherent features, the expansion of major civilizations. And without question, they commanded the largest population concentrations. At its height, the classical Chinese Empire embraced about 54 million people. Classical Rome, at its height, about the same amount of territory, by the way, had about 52 million people. We're less sure about the population of classical India. These were big units in terms of population, dwarfing population levels in other parts of the world. The individual stories become an important part of the classical period, and I want to evoke them briefly, and we'll come back to elements of these in subsequent lectures. During the classical period, China, for example, went from the fairly decentralized, often landlord-dominated Zhao dynasty, which was a long dynasty but not particularly politically coherent, to a major period of centralization under the Xi dynasty, and then the maturation of centralized political and ideological operations under the Great Han dynasty at the end of the classical period. In other words, there's a story within Chinese civilization, and when we emphasize the ultimate durable features of classical China, we're sort of summing up and, frankly, oversimplifying this story. what I'm calling the classical Mediterranean, and this is familiar stuff, of course, what I'm calling the classical Mediterranean started with classical Greece, remembering that Greece was not only concentrated on the peninsula, but also had city-states in other parts of the eastern Mediterranean, and ultimately other places as well, starts with Greece and emphasizes the Greek tradition to its decline in the 4th century. Then the classical Mediterranean would go through the period of Alexander the Great's conquests and the ensuing Hellenistic period in which Greek cultural and political influences interacted with traditions of Egypt and the Middle East, including Persia. And then in the final phase, emphasis shifts to Rome, the Republican period, and then ultimately the empire, which became the most coherent geographic expression of the classical Mediterranean as a whole. Many people accustomed to a more Western-focused history would be happy with more detailed treatment of Greece and Hellenism and Rome as separate entities, and of course they weren't the same thing. But remember, China also in this same period was undergoing important shifts from Zhao to Han, and I'm not sure the Mediterranean experience is necessarily more complicated. We're just accustomed to dealing with it in a somewhat different fashion. Persia represents a somewhat interesting challenge. In its heyday, in the 6th and 5th centuries BCE, Persia was far more important than Greece. And something of a Persian tradition was established with a strong, effective government. The Persian government of this time introduced the first postal system in world history. It organized a series of travelers' inns that facilitated trade and travel throughout the Middle East. It was a successful conqueror, spreading throughout the Middle East, challenging Egypt, obviously ultimately challenging Greece, though unsuccessfully. But the Persian tradition is slightly different because ultimately the Persian tradition would be partially overshadowed first by the conquests of Alexander, but then more importantly by the conquests of Arab Islam. So there is a classical Persia, there is a Persian tradition which crops up recurrently in world history. And obviously today there is something of a reassertion of this tradition in the present-day state of Iran with its growing claims to regional and global political and cultural attention. But it is the Persian tradition is handled a little differently in world history, and I think we're only getting used to the notion that we need to pay more attention to it than we did heretofore. Classical India involves the story of the in-migration of Aryan or Indo-European peoples, long a herding and herding people, their culture, which they brought in from Indo-European roots with elaborate religious stories, which gradually get codified into major works of literature and religious philosophy. Gradually, India, in this second civilization period, settled down into more recognizably coherent development with a major empire in the 4th century BCE, the Mauryan Empire, and at the end of the classical period, another major imperial statement, the Gupta Empire. Separate stories. One of the ways to make sure that the classical period doesn't reduce to a jumble of separate items is, of course, to make sure we emphasize appropriate amounts of comparison. And these comparisons are enlightening in, on the whole, highlighting some of the crucial differences among the classical traditions as they emerged in this period. China, for example, compared to India, is a markedly secular culture. Classical China would generate the Confucian ideology, which is the most important single ideological statement in the East Asian tradition. It would, to be sure, also generate Taoism, a major religion, which, however, never spread significantly beyond China. So the Chinese cultural picture is complex, with different groups and sometimes the same individual holding somewhat conflicting or at least not fully coherent cultural impulses. But on the whole, China's culture was resolutely secular, whereas of all the classical traditions, India was the most spiritual, generating both Hinduism as it gradually emerged from the Indo-European tradition and the religion initially called Brahmanism, and classical India would also generate Buddhism, a religious statement closely akin to Hinduism but opposed to it at key points. Classical Mediterranean may be seen as slightly in between, although on the whole, at least until the advent and spread of Christianity, classical Mediterranean leans more toward the secular side as well. Scientific traditions differed. The Chinese developed a particularly elaborate emphasis on empirical science, science that could be useful to technology, science that could be sponsored as a research activity by the state because of its clear utility to society and the economy. The Greco-Roman, particularly the Greek and Hellenistic scientific tradition, was noticeably more theoretical. India had a major scientific tradition, perhaps a little in between, with a strong emphasis on the development of mathematics, including, of course, the introduction of the numbering system that we now all use, and the introduction of the concept of zero. The Indians were one of the only peoples, not the only one, to develop independently the concept of zero. Politically, the comparison among the societies, and we will amplify this in later discussion, is also revealing. Although the evolution here was gradual, we don't want to see this as an immediate product in classical China. Ultimately, the Chinese emphasis would be on a strong central state, an unusually large bureaucracy. By the height of the Han Dynasty, the Chinese bureaucracy numbered about 1% of the total population, a small figure by modern standards, but truly, truly large by the standards of the classical period. Classical China would also emphasize key political concepts that supported the central state, a specific training system, and at least the beginnings of an examination system for the bureaucrats. There was no other state in the classical period that came close to China in this degree of elaborateness, though at its height, the Persian Empire had some similar features. Indian politics, frankly, involves less emphasis. There are two interesting imperial periods and some other periods when larger political units were formed by outside invaders, but the emphasis, the focus of the Indian tradition as formed in the classical period, tended to stress decentralized smaller states, princedoms, city-states, and placed much less emphasis on political ideas and political ideology than did either classical China or the classical Mediterranean. Classical Mediterranean had, like China, a very strong political emphasis, lots of discussions of the nature of the state, the obligations of citizens. Its overall political tradition was somewhat more decentralized than that of China, though there were some exceptions. Under Rome, somewhat more interested in the development of legal systems as a political unifier rather than the generation of massive bureaucracies. Again, some overlaps and some differentiations. Socially, and we will again pursue this in greater detail later on, India probably generated the most startling social system with its caste system, whose rules and regulations in helping people to determine what they could do by way of occupations, social contacts, marriage opportunities, etc. Caste obligations, in some senses, replaced political obligations and help explain why the Indian political tradition was somewhat less fully developed than was the case elsewhere. Mediterranean society, in terms of social forms, was probably particularly noteworthy for its strong reliance on slavery. Slavery existed also in India and China, but in much more limited and peripheral fashion. Classical China, under Confucian thinking, developed a fairly strong sense of social hierarchy based on the notion of rule by wise people, the upper class, with lower classes emphasizing deference, emphasizing productive activities, a social structure that permitted a little bit of mobility, but with a corresponding emphasis on hierarchy and reciprocal obligation. Economic comparisons are also interesting, and we will trace these in greater detail later on as well. Classical China depended very heavily on trade, but with Confucianism developed a somewhat interesting cultural bias against merchants, who were viewed with some suspicion because of their devotion to money-making, the possibility that they would pull away from the most central political and social values of Chinese society. India placed the most unambiguous emphasis on merchant activities. Merchants formed the third highest caste, and of all of the classical civilizations, India was particularly elaborate in its emphasis on foreign trade and its encouragement for merchants from various parts of India, but particularly the South, its encouragements of merchants to use the Indian Ocean as an artery for trade with other societies. China was particularly successful in its technologies. There's no question that in this period and for several periods thereafter, China would be the most important single source of technological innovation in the world as a whole. And for a long time, a pattern was established by which technologies initially introduced in China would percolate westward gradually through trade contacts and military activities. India also, however, had a successful emphasis on technologies, particularly in areas like steelmaking. The Mediterranean, interestingly, probably had the least well-developed emphasis on production technology, possibly because it was tempted to utilize expansions of the slave system to increase production rather than technological developments per se. The Mediterranean obviously, in some senses, led the world in its feats of civil engineering, although China and Persia were not far behind. But its production technology was not one of the society's great strengths. Okay, obvious point. Even the shorthand form suggests the possibility and desirability of using comparison to highlight some of the interesting differences in flavor of these classical societies and the ways in which some fairly similar opportunities could be defined in such different fashions. It's not always easy, to be honest, to figure out why such different emphases emerged in the classical cases. China may have emphasized political order, possibly because of geography. It was susceptible to invasion from Central Asia, but not too frequently, which may have been just the right balance to encourage an emphasis on order because of a fear of further disruption, but not so much disruption that emphasis became impossible. India was certainly unusually influenced by invasions and influences from the outside through the passes that lead through the Himalayas in northwestern India. Climate may play a role. This is a hoary old historical staple. But India's culture, its emphasis on artistic sensuality, its emphasis on religious fervor could conceivably have something to do with climate factors, with the heat of many areas of India during the spring and summer, with the irregularity of the arrival of periods of heavy rain. I mean, one is fishing here. What is clear is that whatever the origins of these separate impulses and traditions, whether they're climate or contacts with the outside or heritage from the River Valley civilizations or simply the result of creative individuals like Confucius or Socrates, whatever the causes of these differences, they would tend to solidify and would tend to affect these regions not only during the classical period, but well beyond. And that obviously is one of the key points to establish in looking at the place of the classical period in world history as a whole. However, and said this at the outset and I now